It's myself and my colleague Adam Paul.
Good morning.
Hello, Adam. How are you?
Doing just fine. Yourself?
Very well, thank you.
Great, thanks. And we may be joined by some others, but we'll get started. It's the first thing I want to ask you, which is broad, I know, but you know, what do you see as the causes of the financial crisis that we have just been through?
Causes are funny animals.
Yeah.
But let me, if I can, say that without going into it in any great detail, I think there was an error made by the Fed in 2006, 2007. They were way too tight on monetary policy, which sort of was the beginning catalyst, if you will. Now, obviously, there were the preconditions were set, but that's pretty much the initial sort of the... Do you remember a guy named Ibn Browning? Did you ever hear of him?
I don't.
Let me just tell you, how long do you have today? I mean, we have half an hour?
No, we got an hour, if you've got an hour.
All right, sure. Ibn Browning, who was a climatologist from New Mexico and in the 50s, and he had this story, which I love. He said, if you walk into a building and there's a big boiler there, if you turn the heat up on the boiler all the way, and if you go to the safety valves and you turn all the safety valves of the boiler off, all right?
Yeah.
And if you then take a little brass tap hammer and tap the side of the boiler every 15 minutes,
mm-hmm.
by turning the heat on the boiler all the way up and by turning the safety valves off, you've guaranteed that the boiler will explode. By tapping it every 15 minutes with a little brass tap hammer, you've guaranteed to be there when it happens.
Right.
And, you know, the monetary policy was the sort of the tap hammer, if you will. What I really think happened in this economy, my view, is we had an economy that was preconditioned for long-term prosperity, for, you know, minimal intervention, et cetera, high leverage, home values were high, which they were appropriately high. In 1997, we got rid of all the capital gains taxation on homes. You know, home prices were very high, and properly people were using those homes as sort of to borrow to fund whatever else they wanted to fund. It was a very well-run operating system. And then what had happened is the politics of America changed quite dramatically, and that change has now materialized. The way I see it is you had a tight monetary policy that sort of was the catalyst. And then the elections of 2008 were the real precipitators of the crisis. If you look at the market, and I look at a stock market as being a forecaster of what will be, not what has been. Markets to me are forward-looking, not backward-looking. When you look at the stock market, it peaked somewhere in late 2007. And as the election proceeded, it dropped sharply throughout that period, reflecting both the change in Bush and also reflecting the projected change that was coming through Congress and through this administration. That's my view of the world.
Right.
With the fall in the value of assets that happened during then, all sorts of problems arose because the system was geared for much higher asset values than were existing. Loans became called, et cetera, and you got the beginnings of the crisis that have occurred.
Right.
You follow me?
No, I do. Can I go back and
sure.
expand? Have you expand on some of the points you made?
Sure.
So, if you're looking at you, so I assume you said that the tightening in 2006, 2007 was one of the precipitating causes. But let's take it back a little further. I assume then you're supportive of the cutting that Greenspan did after 2001.
Let me tell you that the financial crisis was very similar to the 1999-2000. Crisis. Very, very similar. If you'll remember, in 1999, Alan Greenspan worried about something called a Y2K. All right? What the Fed called the century date change.
Right.
And he was panicked that there would be a trouble with computers and the 9999, if you'll remember, and all the other sort of problems there, the date, the 00 date, taking back to 1900. I don't know if you remember any of that.
No, sure,
stuff.
Of course.
And Alan Greenspan, quite understandably, but I think mistakenly, increased the monetary base radically during the last half of 1999, so there'd be a huge amount of excess liquidity in the system, so that if the computers fell, if whatever happened, and if there were a run on a bank or a financial institution, they would have enough liquidity to meet the withdrawals. And he increased the monetary base very radically. And, of course, on January 2nd, 2000, we all knew that there was no Y2K problem. It was over. There wasn't anything. There were no runs on banks. And he did again, and quite correctly, he withdrew all that excess monetary base out of the system. My view of the world. If you see the monetary base, you can see the huge spike in the last half of 99 and then the sharp drop in the first 2 weeks of January 2000. By pumping that monetary base into the system, he created an excess liquidity, an excess supply of money, and the price of gold rose, the dollar fell on the foreign exchanges, interest rates rose, and we had a stock market, bull market, of unprecedented proportions, especially in those areas where financial constraints were the greatest. In other words, the NASDAQ did much better than the S&P, which did much better than the Dow. But we had a wild, very, very large. And then when he took the monetary base out, the process reversed. And that is almost exactly what I think happened with Ben Bernanke in 2006, early 2007. The only difference between those two events, and by the way, the financial collapse in 2000 was very near as large as the financial collapse in 2008, 2009. The only difference is our responses. In 2000, 2001, we did nothing, which was the right thing to do. You know, it's like a traditional financial collapse. You get this huge conflagration where people who've, you know, borrowed too much money lose their assets. Banks who are undercapitalized go under. And then there's a redistribution and bang, the system starts off again, just as it did in 2000, 2001. That's the right way to handle these crises. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in 2008, 2007, 2008, we didn't do it that way. We stepped in with fiscal policy. We started with the Farm Bill, if you'll remember, and then the Housing Bill in 2007. In March of 2008, we had Larry Summers' stimulus package, which was $600 per capita. You remember that, to the people who didn't work? That was $175 billion. Then we had AIG, which is maybe $185 billion. Then we had some swapping of stuff with Bear Stearns. Then we had Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, which was that's $5.5 trillion worth of takeover there, which maybe, as far as stimulus goes, maybe $500 billion stimulus net. Then we had the Paulson $700 billion. And then, of course, we had the $787 billion of the Obama one, which morphed into $860 billion. And then we have the deficits and all there. We responded to a traditional financial crisis with massive fiscal, redistribution. And it made the crisis catastrophic just the way it did in the 1930s. Gotcha. That's sort of the way I think the answer should have been. We did nothing. You know, we sat back, we held our hands over our ears and shouted, I'm not listening, I'm not listening. But instead, whenever politicians make decisions, when they're panicked or drunk, the consequences are always ugly. And it's a clap.
Right. Let me say that we're joined also by my colleague, Ron Borzakowski, who's an economist.
Hi, Ron. How are you?
It's a pleasure to meet you.
And also,
nice to meet you. You don't look anything like I thought you would, Ron.
And we're also,
I look better over the phone.
Yes. Face for
me
radio.
Too.
And we're also joined by our general counsel, Gary Cohen.
Hello, Gary.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Great. So let's say we go back to 2006, 2007, when Chairman Bernanke is starting to raise rates. Is your point that had they been kept low, we might have avoided all this?
No, well, what happened is he allowed the monetary base to expand way too slowly. You know, what we had was we had a sharp fall in interest rates, a very sharp fall. Now, with interest rates coming down, the demand for money shifts out per unit of GDP. It's the liquidity demand for money, not the transactions demand for money, if you like the Keynesian framework L2. It's the inventory demand for money if you're a monetarist. Whenever interest rates are low, people hold more money per unit transactions. So as these interest rates came tumbling down, and as real GDP growth was very substantial, Bernanke was still trying to fight inflation. And he kept the monetary base growth at zero. In fact, it was slightly negative for a year and a half there. which, you know, which triggered, I believe, the financial preconditions for the catalyst to take effect. And it was classically the same that occurred in the first part of 2000. Just an extraordinarily tight monetary policy where the demand for liquidity was extremely high and there was no liquidity around. That's the way I see the process starting. Then it was doubled down on with fiscal policy doing exactly the wrong thing. You know, the total stimulus funds that they've spent is about $3.6 trillion, the way I calculate it. You know, that's a 1.5 times total tax receipts, federal tax receipts in the year, which are about $2.4 trillion. And my view is that when you give people money based upon some characteristic other than work effort, those resources have to come from workers and producers. I don't think there is any free lunch. You know, I don't think that you can give people resources without taking them from somewhere else. It's a double entry world. And there is no stimulus from the stimulus packages. The recipients clearly are stimulated, but the people from whom the resources are taken are destimulated. The income effects sum to zero. It's just your Slutsky equations if you go back there. If you sum the income effects in an economy, they always sum to zero. So all of this stuff that Larry Summers and Jared Bernstein and all of them were saying about how this will increase demand is nonsense. It is true that the recipients of the money will increase their demand. That's really true. But from people from whom the resources are taken, they will reduce their demand dollar for dollar. And the multiplier is literally zero. The income multiplier is literally zero. Unfortunately, there are substitution effects that come in here. And again, you can take your Slutsky equations and sum them over in a whole economy. If you sum them, the substitution effects always aggregate. If you pay people not to work and you tax people who do work, don't be surprised if you find fewer people working. And that's exactly what these people did. And they did it in huge numbers. Now, every administration has looked for the tooth fairy for a free lunch for Father Christmas. But this one really, really did it. And it was W and Obama combined. Paulson was no better than Geithner. In fact, they were both really horrible. You follow me at all on this?
No, I follow your logic. Let me ask you about, I mean, you're probably best known for your thoughts on tax policy. What is happening during these years on tax policy that you think is important to contributing to the crisis or fear?
Well, tax policy is twofold. One is current and future tax. One is current, the other is future taxes. And it's not really future taxes. What you do by debt is what you do is you give the debt to people and allow them the right to tax people in the future. In other words, if you have 100 apples, and if you give 10 of those apples to people based upon some characteristic other than work effort, someone loses those 10 apples. Now, the only question is, how do they lose them? If you give those 10 to those people who give up the 10 apples bonds, what you do is you allow them to write the right to tax future producers, but the 10 apples are gone now. There is no future tax problem per se. The future tax problem is the people who own the bonds have the right to tax future workers. Do you follow me?
Yes.
So the people from whom you took the 10 apples, they will spend less. They'll have a negative multiplier. The people to whom you give the 10 apples will have a positive multiplier. The net effect will literally be zero. Now, the substitution effects aren't zero. If you give 10 apples out of 100 to people based upon some characteristic other than work effort, the workers and producers who produce those 100 apples will now receive less apples than they otherwise would have received for producing the 100 apples, and they will produce less apples. I had this conversation with Gaylord Nelson in 1974 at Jerry Ford's tax rebate, which is the same damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the stand with Otto Eckstein, Paul McCracken, and I forget who the other one was on the stand with me. And you know, I was trying to explain to him the substitution effects, and my example was as follows. I said, look, if a $600 stimulus package works, what the heck's wrong with you? Why stop at 600? Why not go to 1,000, 6,000, 60,000, a million? Why not 100% of GDP so that everyone who doesn't work and doesn't produce receives everything, and all those who do work and do produce receive nothing? Senator, what do you honestly think would happen to GDP? And the answer is, of course, it would go to zero. And that is exactly what we have been doing for the last 2 years. Every dollar of transfer, every dollar of fiscal stimulus makes GDP fall, not rise. And, you know, we're just going to have to wait until the conflagration is over. But, you know, that is the way it works. There is no multiplier. And it's just a funny set of macroeconomics that is totally inconsistent with microeconomics. And, you know, this is the first real experiment we've had in a long, long time. And we're seeing the results.
Let me ask you, you said that you thought that...
You asked me to give you what I thought. So.
No, I appreciate it. And I just want to parse out some more of what you said. You said that you thought the run-up in housing prices was well justified. Tell us more about why you believe that.
Well, what you had was a very strong boom. You had a very sharp increase in after-tax incomes during that period, which you did. You had a very sharp reduction in unemployment rates and all that sort of stuff. And then you had some very nice features occur. Interest rates came way down. Interest rates coming way down clearly increased the price of houses and the value of a home. Number three, you also had the 1997 Tax Act exempted owner-occupied homes from capital gains, federal and state and local. I mean, by the way, all the states have joined in the federal bill. So there is no capital gains tax on owner-occupied homes, which makes a house much more attractive. And then you have the last one, which is a problem. But you have all these regulations, restrictions, and requirements, especially in California, New York, and the big home states, which takes a long, long time to build a home. This is the old Keynesian accelerator, if you remember. You know, if it takes 5 years from the time you conceive of a home to build it, what you do is you respond to today's price with a supply response 5 years from now. For example, just to get the permits in California, I was on the board of Lion Homes, and just to get the permits takes 2+ years. If you decide you want to do it, you got to buy a farm, you know, a big piece of property. Then you've got to get all the permits through. That takes about 2 years. Then you've got to put in all the infrastructure. Then you sell off each parcel. And you start doing it, and you have to. So you start selling homes maybe 5 years from now, and you finish maybe 9 years from now. So there's a huge lag between the actual desire to have a home and the actual delivery of that home. Let me give you an example. Imagine if you have a static population of 100 families. Anytime one family dies, another family's born. And let's imagine houses depreciate at 1% per annum. What you will is you'll have 100 homes for the 100 families, and you'll have a construction industry that produces the effectiveness of one house per year. You all with me?
Mm-hmm.
Now let's imagine that population growth goes from 0 to 1% per year. What you'll have happening then is while the population is growing at 1% per year, they're adding one new family per year. But the construction industry will go from one home per year to two homes per year. So there'll be a 100% increase in construction for a 1% increase in population growth. This is the old accelerator, Nerxa-Metzler. Okay? Now, if you say it takes 5 years to build a home, what happens? Well, the first year you can't build one. They, oh my God, we need two homes, not one home. But it takes 5 years to get a new home. So they start the process of building a new home. It'll take 5 years. The next year, you'll have need two new homes, three new homes, four new homes. And that is exactly the process that was occurring in California. Instead of allowing the quantities to respond as they should quickly, what happened is you forced all the adjustments in the prices. So you get these very, very large swings in housing prices. But then once the system comes on stream, then it works the other way. So this sort of highly accelerator model building home prices way, way up above and in density of population, all of that stuff. Then it works the other way, coming down. That was exactly where we were in home prices. And the exact wrong response was to tighten money and to have the stimulus packages, my view. And it's caused what we now have. But it wasn't the housing market that caused this. The housing market was the sort of turning the heat up in the boiler a lot, but it wasn't what caused it. But it surely compounded it. If you'll remember, in 2007, the housing problem was really big, and yet the economy did fine.
So just to understand this point, so the house price appreciation is a response, you know, is basically a response to the supply constraint because of time to build.
Two things. It's a response. Number one, it's a response to the supply constraints, which are very constrained. Mm-hmm. And number two, it's from a huge increase in the demand for houses.
Right.
Because of falling interest rates, because of no capital gains tax, because of very sharp increases in after-tax income.
All right, I think that is given. So you have this large demand shock, you're crediting
it. That's exactly correct.
To the late
90s. And then you have a supply constraint.
And then there's a supply constraint. Supply adjusts slowly, prices rise, and eventually supply would catch up and prices would equilibrate.
Yeah, except it takes a long time for those prices to, it takes a long time for that supply constraint to come back on stream.
Okay.
You can't believe how long it takes to get a housing development going in California. I use that because I'm very familiar with it, but other states as well. Some states it's very minor, but in California it takes at least 5-7 years to actually conceive of a house and then sell one.
And in the interim, the changes in monetary policy and the other macro conditions, the potential changes in both future monetary and fiscal policy in 07 and 08 effectively wipe out that, you know, reverse that demand shift.
Yes, they sure do. And they've now really reversed it. And then what the government does is try to recreate it by getting this $8,000 tax credit, which all it does is change the timing of housing purchases.
Right.
And causes the problem to be far, far worse in the long run. You got to just let these markets adjust. You can't pretend you can change their adjustments. But they think they can manipulate the economy when they don't know straight up from sickle.
Now, I guess the conventional wisdom is that a number of financial innovations are contributed to the crisis, that on the demand side for housing, adjustable rate mortgages, then a orgy of securitization, all the way through the banks, increasing leverage and reliance on exotic instruments like CDOs, et cetera. And where do you see financial innovation in all its forms fitting into the crisis?
It is the bread and butter, the fabric of which the whole system is made, and clearly each of those in its own right increase the vulnerability or reduce the vulnerability of the system. But the system generically wasn't caused by those. When you have very low interest rates and they were falling, you expect people to borrow more per dollar of income. When asset values are very high, you expect people to borrow on those asset values. And that was the world we were in 2006, 2007. The leverage shouldn't surprise you because people had no idea that the value of the assets were going to drop like they did. But they did. And that was where the vulnerability, that's where the magnification effect comes through. But these were not the causes of the problem. These were responses to the change in the economy coming into that period. I mean, it shouldn't surprise you that households would borrow a lot more when interest rates fell sharply. Mm-hmm. But remember, everyone they borrowed from, there was someone who lent.
Right.
So it's a zero-sum game. It's just that the leverage in the system increased substantially. Now, that leverage in the system is not a problem per se, unless there's a very sharp change in the collateral values. The thing that caused that was the financial thing and then the fiscal response by government. And the housing problem that I described to you is a very real problem on the delay between a shift in demand demand and the supply's response. It's a real serious problem. But it has been increasing over the years quite substantially. I mean, it's not as though this is a new increase. It's just getting further and further away.
And I take it, would you have in mind for the... What's causing the supply constraint has got to be regulatory impediments and the like?
Yeah, sure, yeah. If you're a home builder in California, I'm going to use California, you know, and you all of a sudden say, you know, I think I'd like to build and sell 1,000 homes. Bang, you make your board decision. Let's do it. Okay, go for it. You've got to find the land. You've got to get it all permitted. You've got to then put in all the infrastructure. You've got to do all of that before you can sell your first land, you know, piece of land, developable land. Then you get a home builder come in there, buys the land, builds a house, and you sell it out in some of these developments over a 5, 6, 7, 8 year period. The time between that you conceive of wanting to have a new home and the actual selling of homes is in the 5 to 8 year range. It takes 2 years completely before you can even start anything on a development property.
Yeah, no. I ask because it's. I mean, this. The one thing that has come down is the time, literal time to build once you have the home and the site. Given preformed trusses and computerization and mills and the like, you know, actually framing a house and filling it has actually come down.
That's way down. That's the minor part of it. You can do it in what? You can really, in some of these homes, if they're not too fancy, you can do it in 3-4 months.
Oh, I mean, I've watched them on ABC, you know, this extreme makeover show on ABC. They do it in a week.
Yeah, but that's where you got 1,000 crews in there. But yeah, you can. It's pretty amazing. But the rest of the stuff takes forever.
Okay.
You know, and not only does it take forever, it costs for I mean, the cost in Orange County per door, it is something on the order of I forget what it is, $80,000-$90,000.
Well,
Sacramento, it's $112,000 or something. I mean, when you think of the fees and permit fees and all that stuff, let alone the time, it's huge.
Well, that alone, though, I don't think you're saying that caused the financial crisis. So,
no, it did not.
I'm actually curious. A lot of one way to look at the crisis. Is the how it happened and the why it happened. If you break up, you know, rather than using the word causes, which could imply, you know, how, why, you know.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm curious if you could separate, in your view, the why and the how, and give us your views of both.
Now, the why and the how, help me a little bit on what you're looking for here.
Well, I'm saying the underlying what changed in the world, or you know, maybe this could have happened in 1974. I just don't know. But what do you see that changed in the world? There's some belief.
Yeah, the politics were the change. There was a difference in the level of response. Congress changed hands in 2006. Bush wanted nothing more than to leave office as fast as he could. He didn't know what to do. He was. And he was like a 5-year-old in a scary movie, squealing and clutching himself. And, you know, really seriously he was. The administration was panicked. And they were terrified that something was terrible was going to happen, so they did something. And that is exactly what shouldn't have happened. You had the Paulson $700 billion. You had the additional amount of the, as I mentioned, in the housing bill in 2007, the additional amount in the farm bill. You had the Larry Summers stimulus package in March of 08, if you remember that, $600 bucks per capita, $1,200 for a couple. You know, it was $170 billion or something like that. So that's what really happened, is these people thought they could stave it off by stimulating the economy when, in fact, they were hurting it.
But do you think, though, that if they had not done that, the crisis would not have happened?
Yes. I think the crisis would have been much smaller. And I think it had been over very quickly. It had been like 2000. And you would have had a very sharp swing in asset values, which we did in 2000, but we would have had very minor amounts of output, employment, production damaged.
You know, if you go back to that, then what is your view on the, you know, the assisted suicide of Bear and the allowing Lehman to go under and then...
Let them all go under.
So you would have just stepped back, let the markets...
Yes, I would have completely stepped back and let the markets handle it. In fact, that was... you know, and I know all my friends were saying the opposite. Jack Kemp and Steve Forbes were squealing like five-year-olds in the movie. But, you know, my view was this is a natural thing that's happening. Let it go. It's very unpleasant. And if I could tell you a cool way of short-term stopping it, I would love to, but that's not where we were. You just sit back and you know, when people make decisions when they're panicked, and I've watched, I've been in the White House, God knows how many thousands of years, and I watched Nixon do the Camp David in August 1972. I watched it with 71. I watched it with Watergate, what happened when they make a panicked decision because of a crisis. I've watched Jerry Ford do the whip inflation now. Jimmy Carter do his national energy plan. They all make things a lot, lot worse. And I would have sat there and done nothing had I been in charge of the government.
Let me ask you, I've heard you say you were a two-time Clinton voter.
Yes.
And is there anything to be learned from the financial crises of his second term, the Asian crisis, the long-term capital management?
Yeah, exactly. I think Greenspan handled those perfectly. I really do. He changed the monetary base. You know, it's the old lady of Threadneedle Street. Who was it? The writer who did it. In times of crisis, discount freely. But when the crisis is over, get the hell the money out of there. And Greenspan handled the 9/11 well. I mean, really well. He handled the Asian crisis. He had long-term capital management, I thought, perfectly. In both those cases, he made sure that there was plenty of liquidity for the banks for the short-term crisis period, and then removed that liquidity as soon as the crisis was over. That was Walter Badgett. It was the Badgett model.
So are you comfortable with any of the liquidity provision through 07 and 08, things like primary dealer credit facility, term structure lending facility, extended terms of the discount window, any of the sort of Fed actions to improve liquidity?
It would have been a very nice thing to have done a minor amount in 2007 instead of tightening continuously and fighting inflation. That was when the crisis was happening. That would have been lovely. By the time the Fed got involved, which was very late after fiscal policy had doubled down, by that time it was over. The Fed was powerless. And their expansion of the monetary base, as you know, they've expanded the monetary base something on the order of 140% increase. They've increased bank reserves 25-fold. You know, that is a catastrophe. And that will come back to get us.
So a smaller amount of liquidity provision earlier in the crisis.
Very early on, yeah. But once you start a spiral of a liquidity spiral, you know, liquidity crises turn into net worth crises very quickly. They turn into liquidity crises turn into solvency crises. Mm-hmm. What you want to do is stop the liquidity crisis right away with the provisional liquidity. But once you've got a liquidity crisis in motion, it becomes a solvency issue very quickly. You saw what happened to asset values and all that.
Yeah.
That's what happened. We did not provide the liquidity solution quickly, and we turned it into a solvency problem.
But just to push a little further, is the solvency problem caused by sort of overdoing it with liquidity provision? Your concern is much more your concern is much more on the fiscal side with just pumping fiscal stimulus at this starting in 08.
That's what's made it an economic crisis rather than a financial crisis. What should have been done is in 2007 early, the Fed should have allowed the monetary base to grow far more rapidly and made sure the system had liquidity to be able to handle the financial demand for money that was occurring. They didn't. Once you get a financial crisis going, asset values start. Once you get the financial crisis going and asset values start falling, all of a sudden you have a solvency problem.
Well, you've got your self-fulfilling prophecies. And
yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's just built into it. That's exactly right. Now, and then there's no way out.
But do you think, though, then, had there been an increase in liquidity in early 07, that would have prevented the collapse?
That surely would have slowed it way down, if not stopped it.
Of the housing market.
Yeah, and then what would have happened, not the housing market per se, I don't, you know, the housing market was going to happen anyway because of those long lags between demand and the supply response. That was going to happen, but it wouldn't cause a national economic crisis. You don't just add up each industry to get the total.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a Le Chatelier's model here, that if housing doesn't do well, some other sector will make up for the slack if the overall macro is fine. But then you needed to have the liquidity to keep the asset values from falling and causing it to be a solvency issue.
Certainly in other asset classes anyway.
Yeah, no, it's spread everywhere.
Yeah.
And then once that happens, then you've got to rush to liquidity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the demand curve for liquidity increase just skyrocketed. Well, you know, the last thing you want to do is be short of money in a financial crisis. And you can see, even today, the demand for money is huge on the part of institutions.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, for good reason. I mean, you know, they're rightfully holding on.
If I could then back up and summarize what you've said, a lot of the whys with respect to the underlying stresses that the system built up and built up and built up and then exploded in 07, 08, I guess if I could state what your view is that if had the situation been handled with an appropriate preemptive liquidity infusion in 07, what became the monster crisis would have been another mild recession, small issue.
Yeah, very sharp swing in asset values,
right.
And it would have been over.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd not have the fiscal responses that we had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The fiscal responses made it a small recession into the Great Recession. If they had not done the $3.5 trillion worth of stimulus, this would have been a minor recession. Not the Great Recession it is. And if they go into next year and double down again, you've got it a lot longer. You know, who ever heard of trying to tax yourself out of a recession? It's silly. If you tax people who work and you pay people who don't work, don't be surprised if you find a lot of people not working.
You've spoken a lot about the rebalancing in the financial sector, but given that you sort of thought that prices would come down as the supply sort of caught up on the housing side, were households mistaken to sort of leverage so much on the future expectations of home prices?
Probably some of them were, but you know, a lot of them had huge capital gains already built into their homes. I mean, that was part of their portfolio of wealth. You know, if I gave you, $100 million, how much would you save out of next week's paycheck? I mean, not very much. You'd be out shouting your friends beer. You know, and these people had a windfall asset appreciation. And so they were taking advantage of it by increasing their spending, which is very natural, especially when they can borrow at low interest rates. And they have a lot of capital appreciation in one of their major assets. They were behaving quite rationally. Now, some of them weren't, obviously. Some of them way over-borrowed, and some of them were doubling down and doing all that stuff, and banks were winking at mortgages because they didn't worry about it. They thought the appreciation could last forever. But that wasn't the entire system.
Sure.
That was examples of this, that, or the other. And there were banks that were undercapitalized. There were people who were over-levered in their homes. That's all true. Those people would have been nailed under any circumstances. They were just playing a crapshoot game. But that happens a lot in financial crises. That's what the nature of a financial crisis. It's the fiscal response to it that was so devastating.
So you would have seen, as the supply came online, you would have seen some correction in the housing sector in those particular assets, expected.
Yep.
Those people that overborrowed, yeah, they would have been whacked, but you know, we have somewhat of a safety net or something. And
yep.
If the banks that had over-leveraged or were too concentrated in real estate got whacked with that price, what you would imagine to be a minor price correction.
Well, that would have been a major price correction, but it wouldn't have been a systemic correction.
Okay, but that would have been tributary destruction, right? I mean, we would have gotten rid of the weaker banks with the less
active
boards.
Yeah, and it would have been done quickly, not extended the way it is now.
And you would
by giving these people excess funds and by keeping them on. And by doing these home things, you don't get the market correct.
Okay, so but you would have seen this as even potentially a sharp correction in asset values.
Yeah.
There would have been some hit to GDP?
Probably, but it's been relatively small. What you know about financial crises is they have lots of effect on asset values, very little on output, employment, production. This is the 19th century. All these financial crises had very little impact on real output, employment, production. But they had a lot of effect on asset values. Once you turn it into a fiscal crisis or a trade crisis, then it has huge effects on output, employment, production. The origin of the disturbance really dictates the response of the system. And financial crises are responded to in prices of value, the assets, not in output, employment, production. Fiscal crises change output, employment, production. That's why we never had a major depression prior to, you know, prior to the Great Depression. We just didn't have the fiscal wherewithal to cause a Great Depression. But we had lots of financial crises before.
No, the 19th century is full of them.
Yeah, and without real output effects. I mean, I don't mean without any real output effects, but with very minor ones. It was like the 2000. I mean, we had a huge asset value swing, as you know, but very little output. I mean, the NBER was barely able to classify it a recession. But this one, they were, because the fiscal system stepped in and made it a truly, they turned it from a fiscal crisis to an economic crisis.
So you wouldn't put the blame, I take it, on, I mean, one big difference, let me put it this way, one big difference between 2000 and now is the nature of the asset that had the inflated price, or the high price. I don't want to, it's a judgment that it's inflated or bubbled, but the high price.
True.
And the nature of the institutions holding it, right? So stock ownership has a particular pattern, stocks have a particular, equities have a particular pattern of ownership relative to debt.
Well, that's very true. All those are very true. If you look at stock prices relative to capitalized economic profits, stock prices were extraordinarily high relative to capitalized economic profits in 99, early 2000. They were not high in 2007. Stock prices were not way overvalued compared to profits and interest rates and tax rates.
Right. So, so we think that 99-2000 is big. You know, the bubble to the extent there is one is in equities. It seems to be more a real estate, as you've explained, real estate prices were expected to correct here. Real estate is a leveraged asset. Equities generally aren't.
And I'm sure the leverage really magnified the effect. That's true.
Okay, which is why you said that there would have been, you know, there could have still been a substantial contraction, and you could have had a substantial correction in the asset price and a bigger hit to, potentially bigger hit to GDP.
Yeah, there's no question, in my mind at least, that there would have been a correction in housing prices, and a substantial one. I mean, that's why I resigned from the board of Lion Homes back then, when I wrote a piece called California, Who Are You? And Why I'm Leaving California and Moving to Tennessee. And, you know, that I did it in March of 2006, which was exactly the description I've given you right now. It was clear as a bell to me, and, you know, I was on the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. He made me come up and give a presentation to him as well, which I did, and I thought he was screwing the state up and making it worse. And, you know, that's where I was back then. I did not think it would lead to a great recession, but the fiscal responses made that happen. And then you got Obama in, and the Congress here, which, you know, double down on everything. If 100 million won't cure it, 100 billion will make sure it will cure it.
Let me see if I understand what you were saying earlier about the election in 2008. Was it the fear of Obama raising taxes that contributed to this?
Well, yes, and not just Obama. It was the whole process, but Obama was clearly a major portion of it, yes. Bush had conceded quickly and did the Paulson stuff, which was outrageous. Had gone along with Larry Summers' stimulus package and Pelosi and Reid, as you remember, in the 2008. They'd gone along with that, which was just, I think, silly. They did the 2007 Farm Bill and Housing Bill, which was wrong, I believe, and they bailed out AIG, they bailed out all these others. They did all of that, and then they did the Fannie Mae Freddie Mac, which was another big one. All of that was the thing that really doubled down on the process, and that is a political response. That political response did not occur in 2000, 2001. it was that political response manifested through the stimulus monies that really caused us to be the Great Recession.
Just to go back for a second, would you be willing to share that particular paper you mentioned? I don't know if you can share the presentation.
Sure, I can share any of them you want with it. I'll take you through all of them. I wrote them all at the time.
If you could send them to Matt, that would be...
I'll send them to Ashley.
All right. I'll do California, Who Are You? You can see exactly what I wrote on that. All right, and I'll do my fiscal crisis one with you. Would you like a monetary crisis, why the demand for money had accelerated and how Ben Bernanke was not responding correctly with the monetary base? I'll send you that paper, which I wrote at that time.
Yeah, no, I'd be interested in reading them.
And then I don't want to core dump on you. It's just it's a classical view of the world that I've got, but that's what I've always had.
Yeah, no,
I can send you the stuff on the fiscal responsibilities and what's happening there. I mean, you know, that's what I did at the business roundtable keynote. In my book, I've got it all there, but I'll be glad to send it to you.
I was browsing the book earlier. I mean, you can tell me what's easy. Is it easier to?
What I do in the book, it goes through very carefully why there is no stimulus in the stimulus packages. By the way, the other one on the platform with me in '74 was Gardner Ackley. You know, when you're my age, it takes a while to remember all these things. But it goes through very carefully in the Return to Prosperity. You want to use the book Return to Prosperity and go through exactly the fiscal, and what I do is I go through it very, very carefully. You know, if you have a two-person economy, let's say two farmers, if you give one of those farmers unemployment benefits, guess who pays those unemployment benefits? The other farmer. There is no stimulus, net stimulus in the system. You know, the whole idea that if you increase unemployment benefits, these people will stimulate the economy and reduce unemployment is about the dumbest thing I've ever heard from my perspective. I mean, if you wanted to have less apples in the economy, what would you do? You'd tax apple consumers for consuming apples.
Mm-hmm.
You'd tax apple producers for producing apples, and you would pay apple producers not to produce apples and use their money elsewhere.
I imagine that's your description of the historic farm bills.
Well, that's the farm bill. That's also our unemployment bill. We tax people who employ people. We tax the people who are employed, and then we pay people who could be employed not to be employed. It's about as dumb as anything I've ever heard. And it's the same debate we're having in every one of these debates. So I don't know if you saw my piece in the Journal a couple days ago.
I did, yeah.
You know, if you look at it, it's very clear that the elasticity of taxable income for upper-income people is very, very high. These people can hire lawyers. They can hire accountants. They can hire deferred income specialists. They can hire congressmen. And they have many, many avenues open to them to not report taxable income. They can change the volume of their income, they can change the timing of their income, they can change the location of their income, they can change the composition of their income. So these people are extraordinarily sensitive to tax rates, much more so than anyone else. If you raise the tax rates on the highest income earners, you're going to lose money because these people will respond. I mean, let me give you the wealthiest guy in America. His name is?
Bill Gates.
Bill Gates, Warren Buffett. If I showed you Warren Buffett's balance sheet today, if I had it hit right in my hand and I'm sitting there with you and I just pull up this balance sheet, what would you see on the asset side? You'd see stock in Berkshire Hathaway, wouldn't you?
I imagine that's most of his wealth.
Yeah, and then if you take the exercise cost out of it, you would have his wealth being principally unrealized capital gains. You with me?
Yep,
sure.
Now, the tax rate on unrealized capital gains today is...
We don't tax unrealized gains.
Oh, and now the wealthiest people in America have all of their wealth in what form? Duh. It shouldn't surprise you that these people change their balance sheet according to the tax structure. You know, these people don't pay any tax. And if Warren Buffett actually does give that money to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, it will never be taxed. What he does is he issues stock options to himself and the company. He borrows on his wealth. And then what he does is he realizes those stock options, the income from those stock options, to offset the interest on the expense. And they all do that. It shouldn't surprise you. I moved from California to Tennessee for one reason and one reason alone. There's no income tax in Tennessee. And I can tell you how much money I've saved. Not only do I save on state and local taxes, but I also am no longer subject to the AMT because state and local taxes are a preferred item. I mean, it's amazing. There are so many things people can do on deferring and all this stuff. It's incredible.
So I can use you as an example of the TV.
Please don't. I would prefer you not to.
I promise, but I won't do it when I teach. But the TBU hypothesis that people are actually going to respond to the level of public goods provision and taxes by walking.
Yes, of course they walk. But taxes redistribute people, not income. And, you know, if you look at who are the people suffering today, they're the lowest group. I mean, it's so sad because, you know, these people who profess to love the poor so much that they want to make everyone poor. The dream today is to make the poor rich, not to make the rich poor. You know, these people who are unemployed, it's a tragedy that they're unemployed. But, you know, the guys who have made them unemployed then use their plight as the excuse for why they need to cause them more damage. It's like the, you know, the example Milton used to use that I loved when he tried to explain this point, but he said it's sort of like the guy who kills his parents and then begs for mercy from the court because he's an orphan. And that's what's happening. These people are saying, how can you not help the unemployed? It's so terrible. But in fact, you're causing them to be unemployed. Well, you know what my model is.
It's a
classic model of economics, and it's, you know, it's not very it's not very prominent in the economics profession today, but you know it.
We do indeed. Well, thank you for your time. We really appreciate your taking time out of your schedule.
Then I will not send you the fiscal stuff, because if you've got the book, you've got the whole thing on why there's no net stimulus. And what I do is I go through the income effects and the substitution effects of fiscal policy. Bingo.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I will send you the liquidity one I wrote back a long time ago, which is called Money Matters.
Yep.
Okay.
And I will send you the other paper, which is California, Who Are You? With their dates, and I'll send them to you, Matt.
That's great. I'll make sure Ashley has my email.
I think I've got it here, but thanks. If you would make sure Ashley does, and I'll send it to you right away.
Okay. That'd be fantastic. I look forward to reading them.
Okay. Well,
thank you very much,
thank
everybody.
Thank you so much, Arthur.
Talk to you later.
Take care.
Take
Bye.
Care.
Bye.